Wildfires are raging across Australia, and scientists there are turning to Indigenous communities to help manage dry lands.
Fire will always come. That's just when it comes. And so our law is about us putting the right fire in at the right time.
Also, 2020 will be a huge election year across the globe, and Facebook will play a massive role.
Even Ghana, even in New Zealand, even in Burma, social media is going to start to be the way of reaching voters.
The UK says civil unions aren't just for gay couples anymore. So how does a straight couple get the ball rolling?
We kind of had this little tussle about who got down on one knee.
Who proposed to who?
We agreed that we proposed to each other.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. We start today in Australia, where wildfires are burning out of control across the country. Temperatures have risen above 40 degrees Celsius, that's 104 degrees Fahrenheit, in every state in Australia. The wildfires have killed 10 people since September. They've destroyed nearly 10 million acres of land. That's like two New Jerseys going up in flames. The Australian state of Victoria in the southeast is seeing some of the worst damage. And it's likely to get even worse, says Andrew Crisp. He's the Emergency Management Commissioner for Victoria.
This is a high-risk day for Victoria. This is a day we do not often see. Our state is dry. It is going to be very hot. It is going to be very, very windy.
Earlier, 35,000 people in the city of East Gippsland were told to flee. But as conditions got worse, Emergency Services spokesman Luke Hegarty said they should stay put.
Unfortunately, it appears that our concerns have been realised this afternoon. These fires have continued to grow, and now for a very large part of East Gippsland, our advice to people is that it is too late to leave. They need to be sheltering inside their homes. The fires are continuing to spread.
The sky just completely changed in colour. It just got darker and darker as fire got closer towards us.
Elise Kinsella is with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She was reporting from a centre for displaced families in East Gippsland.
The temperatures are still sitting around 40 degrees here and just really hot winds. And there are fires throughout eastern Victoria.
And throughout the entire continent. Around 100 wildfires are burning right now from the Northern Territory to the island of Tasmania. Australia's capital city, Canberra, hasn't been spared. People there have seen this kind of devastation before. As Kyle Vass reports from Canberra, there are still lessons to be learned.
In Australia, it's tough to get away from the fires. The city of Canberra has been transformed into a hazy, cough-inducing smokescape. People here still remember what happened back in 2003. The Australian capital was taken by surprise when strong winds shifted and suddenly residents looked up to see a nearby mountain completely ablaze. Liz Tilley says she had no idea how quickly the fire would arrive at her front door.
We said to the emergency services guy on the corner, what do we do? Because that's not far from us at all. And he said, go inside, close the windows and doors and wait till we tell you to evacuate. But the fire got so intense where we are that no one ever came back.
Tilley says she and her family found themselves trapped inside with no escape route, face to face with a wildfire that was consuming their house.
The noise was like nothing I've ever heard. It was like a beast trying to get into every tiny crack. If there was any crack, there'd be flames coming in.
When the roof started to cave in, Tilley and her family went outside, and somehow a relative's car had been spared. That's how they got away.
They called it a once-in-100-years fire, which seems laughable now, given what's happened in Australia.
Veteran firefighter and park manager Brett McNamara also lost his home in 2003. Now he's back out there, helping to fight this latest round of fires in New South Wales.
You don't think you're going to experience a 2003, you know, more than once in your life as a firefighter. And I've certainly been on the fire ground the last few weeks. We've been down the south coast there. And some of the devastation I've seen down there is just so much like 2003 all over again. It's almost like this is on steroids this time round.
McNamara has more than 40 years of firefighting experience. He says there is no doubt that climate change is making the current fire much worse.
I've seen a lot in terms of nature saying, you know what, things aren't normal. Things are starting to change. The frequency and the intensity of fires in the last 15 years has ramped right up.
Drought conditions are the problem, McNamara says. They create highly flammable fuel loads in the forms of dead grass, trees, leaves, and twigs. To To explain what he means, McNamara takes me out to Namaji National Park, where he works, to show just how dry the bushlands are right now.
Many years ago, I had a chappie who worked out here, and he used to talk about the cornflakes crunch factor. So think of cornflakes as you pour them into your bowl. And what do they make? That noise they make.
It's snap, crackle, pop.
Yeah. Right. So what we have here at the moment, it is so dry that the cornflakes crunch factor underfoot is almost at extreme. And all you've got to do is just walk through where we are here to understand how dry it is. So let's just go for a walk here and see what I'm talking about.
As we walk through the eucalyptus trees, the floor of the bushland is covered in brittle tree bark and dead leaves. Brett offers me a handful.
So you've got to pick that up and just snap that. Even with the kookaburras laughing in the background, you get a sense for how dry it is.
According to Oliver Costello, climate change is a part of what's going on here, but it's not the whole story.
The reality is it's because the land's being mismanaged.
Costello is the head of a group called Fire Sticks, a network of indigenous communities that work to incorporate their cultural knowledge into Australia's land management policies.
Most Aboriginal communities were displaced from their cultural landscape, so they were moved into missions or reserves, and now we've got huge swathes of land that don't have people looking after them anymore.
Costello says the Western approach to land conservation can be counterproductive.
I really love national parks, but a lot of national parks are just really under-resourced and under-managed. And because the Western mindset is just sort of like put a fence around it and stop people from being in there and wrecking it, and it just doesn't work.
Indigenous land management means getting people onto protected lands, not just keeping them off. And for many Indigenous people, there's a cultural knowledge that burning the ground is essential to regenerating life in Australia. But Costello says the Western ways are geared towards avoiding fire at all costs.
One of the first things kids learn, oh, don't touch that, it's hot. For us, culturally, it's the wrong learning, because it's don't be scared, understand. Like, you don't be scared, like, don't touch it. Know not to touch it. Like, it's a different way of thinking. Like, know that where you live in, if you live in fire country, you need to burn the country.
Periodic burning makes the land more fertile and prevents the buildup of flammable organic material, the cornflake crunch factor.
If you don't have a minor disturbance through fire, which is actually can stimulate growth and, you know, create different relationships between species, plants, animals and stuff. If you don't do that, all you're doing is letting the fuel build up and a big fire will come through, because the fires will come. This is the story of this place. Fire will always come. That's just when it comes. And so our like law is about us putting the right fire in at the right time, you know, so that it's not the wrong fire at the wrong time, which is what we're seeing now, you know.
Adopting Indigenous burn practices might be the key to preventing the kinds of fires that are raging in Eastern Australia today, says Justin Leonard. He's with Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization.
And I guess the question is, how do we find the workforce to step up and maintain that?
Oliver Costello, who's from an Indigenous family himself, says people from Aboriginal communities are ready and waiting to take more responsibility, and that Australia just needs to decide to look closer at its past to secure the future. For The World, I'm Kyle Vass, Canberra, Australia.
The Jewish community in a suburb of New York is recovering from a ghastly attack over the weekend. A man wielding a machete in Monsey, New York, injured five people during a Hanukkah celebration. It comes after a string of anti-Semitic incidents in the New York area in recent weeks. And over the past decade, Jewish communities across the globe have become targets in places like Britain, Germany, and France. Isaac Herzog is in Jerusalem. He chairs the Jewish Agency, the world's largest Jewish organization, which works to strengthen connections between Jews around the world, including promoting Jewish immigration to Israel. I asked him whether we are witnessing a global rise in anti-Semitism.
Absolutely. Not only the newsreels, but the data in terms of objective research. We see a very dramatic and disturbing rise. And I say that since World War II, we didn't have such an era of hate and anti-Semitism as we have today.
The Jewish Agency, the organization that you're the head of, says that one way to combat anti-Semitism is to meet with leaders around the world. And I know that's partly what you do. What are they telling you about their plans to protect Jews living in their countries?
So we don't meet for the sake of meeting. I can tell you, for example, following a terror attack which Jews faced in Germany on our holiest day, the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, last September, I wrote to all the leaders of Europe. I got an incredible letter back from the Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, outlining a whole plan of combating anti-Semitism. I expect to see that by all leaders of the world. I expect to see a common plan that deals with fighting anti-Semitism and hate. Because at the end, you know, history shows us it starts with Jews, it never ends with Jews.
When attacks like the one that happened in Manzi over the weekend, when they happen, how does it affect the day-to-day life and religious practice of Jews?
It has a huge impact. You know, I went and met rabbis in communities in North America in the last year following the horrific murder and terror attack in Pittsburgh back in 2018. You know, the whole community has to rearrange the notions of what security and safety is all about. Locking doors, putting guards on doors. Explain to children why there is police near their plow space of worship. How come, you know, in the greatness of America, Jews never were threatened or other people by practicing their religion? What has happened that all of a sudden human beings, American citizens, want to worship the Lord Almighty in their own belief, have to think twice before they go to their place of worship? This is exactly the price people are paying because of these horrific attacks.
In 2015, there was a string of terror attacks in Paris, which killed five Jews. At the time, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called on French Jews to immigrate to Israel to be safe. Is that really the solution?
I want to make it clear. All Jews have the full right, like any other human being, to live in dignity and safety wherever they are and practice their belief wherever they are. There are 6 million Jews in America. They are proud citizens of the United States, and they need to be protected like anybody else. Apart from that, there is a great, you know, manifest destiny of the Jewish people in their nation state, the state of Israel. But that's a different chapter.
Isaac Herzog, do you think that anti-Semitism in America and Europe, do you think that there are differences in how it is being acted out or what's motivating it?
It's a beautiful question because whilst there are many comparisons, there are also differences. The accessibility to guns, the nature of the ability to operate, and the common feeling of the people. But all in all, the outcome, the results are the same. Jews fearing harassment and attacks. We're talking about attacks on graveyards, on synagogues, on schools, or swastikas in campuses, things that are unacceptable and we've never seen in the last generation before.
Isaac Herzog is the chairman of the Jewish Agency. He's been speaking with us from Jerusalem. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're just 2 days from 2020. It's a big election year. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has our take.
If you already have a bit of fatigue when it comes to the U.S. presidential election, stay with me. A bunch of other countries are holding elections next year for president, parliament, and legislatures. People on six continents will cast ballots. In Ethiopia, voters will decide in May whether reforms ushered in by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed in 2018 should continue.
Peace is a labor of love. Sustaining peace is hard work.
That's Ibe accepting the Nobel Peace Prize in December for his peacemaking efforts with Eritrea. But the award was controversial. Critics say Ibe hasn't fulfilled the promises he made, and many blame his policies for an uptick in ethnic violence in the country. Next fall, New Zealanders will decide whether Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's progressive politics can stick around for another term. Ardern's poll numbers increased significantly after her response to the shootings that targeted Muslims in Christchurch last March.
We each hold the power in our words and in our actions and our daily acts of kindness. Let that be the legacy of the 15th of March, to be the nation we believe ourselves to be.
But current polls show 2020's race is likely to be a close one for Ardern and her Labour Party. Meanwhile, another group of countries is hoping their elections will snap them out of political paralysis and constitutional crises. like Sri Lanka, Israel, Bolivia, Venezuela, and Hong Kong.
All those elections next year are going to be addressing, can the election moment break the logjam or break the crisis?
That's Andrew Reynolds, a global elections expert at the University of North Carolina. One country to look out for is Bolivia. Bolivians are headed back to the polls next spring after a contested election that ultimately ended with President Evo Morales stepping down. And there are a lot of questions about what's next. So are people there excited to have another vote?
Excited is not the word.
That's journalist Fernando Molina in La Paz. But he says voters are desperate to express their feelings about Morales, and they're required by law to vote. Morales himself won't be on the ballot, but his Movement for Socialism party will be. No matter the country, one thing you'll see more of in 2020 elections is social media. Here's Reynolds again.
The British election this time was the first election that I've seen where social media really became the dominant way of communicating. But even Ghana, even in New Zealand, even in Burma, social media is going to start to be the way of reaching voters.
Of course, the downside of that is many more opportunities for manipulation and the spread of disinformation and potentially foreign meddling. And finally, there's one more thing 2020 elections might bring, says Reynolds, and that is more elected officials who look, sound, and have shared experiences with an increasingly diverse electorate. For an example of that, Reynolds says, just look at New Zealand's government right now.
It is Maori. It is Pacific Islander. It is female. It is straight and gay. It is a rainbow reflection of that nation. And that's not how it was 40 years ago.
One thing that's not likely to change in the coming year, the sense of frustration that voters have with their elected officials. Reynolds says that even though the quality of elections is generally improving, many voters around the world still feel that their elected leaders don't represent them. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Another country set to hold elections next year is Somalia. It hasn't had a stable government since 1991, when rebels toppled military strongman Ziad Barre. That's back when George H.W. Bush was president. Now the major threat to Somalia's fragile state is the militant group Al-Shabaab. Today it claimed responsibility for a massive truck bomb detonated at a busy Mogadishu intersection. The blast on Saturday killed at least 79 people and has left the city in shock. Dr. Abdulkader Adan is the founder and head of Mogadishu's only free ambulance service. He heard the blast and arrived at the scene quickly.
The scene was very devastating, and it is really painful for the family, for the father, for the mother. We are traumatized. It was very big loss for the country. It was a tragic day.
Murithi Mutiga follows the militant group Al-Shabaab closely from his base in Nairobi. He's the Horn of Africa project director for the International Crisis Group.
I think the very gruesome and bloody attack over the weekend just demonstrates that Al-Shabaab retains a capacity to attack almost at will in major urban centers in Somalia.
Now, African Union troops are on the ground in Somalia targeting Al-Shabaab. The U.S. military is targeting them in drone strikes. Why are they so resilient?
One of the major factors behind Al-Shabaab's staying power is the fact that the state is so weak. For more than 15 years now, there has been an effort to stand up a Somalia national army. Unfortunately, Somalia's politics remains very fractured. There's a lot of division among the political elite. They've been unable to cultivate consensus. Where the state is unable to offer citizens even the most basic services, then it has very little connection with its people. So its intelligence gathering capacity is very weak. By contrast, Al-Shabaab's network is very sophisticated. It levies taxes across the country. It has shown a continued capacity to infiltrate even state institutions. So a state weakness is without question the most important factor contributing to Al-Shabaab's continued strength.
Now, this blast on Saturday, it took place next to a small group of Turkish engineers who were in Mogadishu constructing a road. The government of Turkey has been active in Somalia since 2011. Are they a likely target?
It is quite possible. We've seen attacks against Turkish installations and individuals before. Turkey has been very active in trying to restore basic services in many parts of Somalia. Ankara now has its biggest embassy abroad in the Somalia capital, Mogadishu. It runs the largest hospital. And most importantly, it is also trying to train a very effective Somali elite army unit. That unit has launched substantial operations against Al-Shabaab. There is a possibility that they might have been targets in retaliation, but at this stage, it's too early to tell exactly.
So related to that is the fact that Somalia is set to hold elections in 2020, and this will be the first popular vote in the country in decades. Is this election more likely to be stabilizing or destabilizing in terms of what could happen in this fragile nation?
Opinion is divided about this very big push to have a one-person, one-vote election, both in 2020 and 2021. It is a laudable objective because if you have a more legitimate government, perhaps the citizenry can pressure them to deliver better than the current ones and the previous ones. But in reality, it is very doubtful that Somalia will be ready for universal suffrage. I think it's more realistic that you build the state, strengthen the state, and then look for democracy as a goal that follows a stronger state. There is some credence to those that criticize this overwhelming effort to pursue a one-person, one-vote in a situation where you cannot guarantee security.
Murithi Mutiga is project director for the Horn of Africa with the International Crisis Group. He joined us from Nairobi. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
President Trump is exerting a maximum pressure campaign on Iran. Crippling sanctions are designed to hurt the government there, but they're also taking a toll on small businesses.
I can say I have seen with my own eyes how much people are suffering.
This Iranian wants a thaw, but Trump has to decide, will he be a deal maker or a hardliner? That's coming up on The World. Top Shiite cleric in Iraq today called on his government to prevent the country from turning into a, quote, arena for settling regional and international disputes. That warning came from Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. He was referring to U.S. airstrikes carried out inside Iraq on Sunday. They were aimed at Iranian-backed militia bases in Iraq. It's another example of the proxy fight between the U.S. and Iran. We'll hear more about the airstrikes and what led up to them in a few minutes. But first, The World's Shirin Jafari reports on how the nuclear issue is still at the heart of the diplomatic standoff between the U.S. and Iran.
To most Americans, this video wouldn't seem out of the ordinary. It shows a young woman in a bright orange headscarf dancing and singing loudly on the subway in Tehran. Other passengers join in, and soon the whole cabin is singing, clapping, and dancing. But here's why this video went viral on Iranian Twitter. Singing and dancing in public has been banned in Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. But Iranians are pushing back, and not just against this rule, but so many others.
Being born after a revolution, we are raised by just hope.
But these days, hope is harder to find, says Leila Daleshwar, who lives in Tehran. The Iranian economy is so bad, people are in no mood to celebrate. In 2018, President Trump walked away from the Iran nuclear deal, signed by the Obama administration and a group of world powers. That agreement limited Iran's nuclear activities, and Iran got some sanctions relief in return. But President Trump said he wanted his own deal, a better deal. And the way he's tried to get that better deal is to squeeze Iran's economy so hard, its leaders would be forced to come back to the negotiating table. The Trump administration refers to this policy as a maximum pressure campaign.
It went from bad to worst.
Daneshwar, the Tehran resident, runs a company that makes devices for people with disabilities. She says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign prevents her company from importing raw material.
We import ABS, which is a type of plastic we used to import from China. That company told us that they cannot sell that product to us.
At least not anymore, because of U.S. sanctions. Her company is searching for other sources, but in the meantime, prices have shot up. She says high inflation, unemployment, and economic uncertainty leaves many Iranians frustrated. And they've been expressing their anger. Last month, hundreds of people poured into the streets to protest a massive spike in gas prices. The government cracked down on the demonstrators with deadly force. Estimates of people killed range from 300 to 1,500. Nasser Hadian teaches international relations at Tehran University.
There is no doubt about it that the sanctions are hurting Iranian. And also the protest has been very important to change the calculus, but mostly of the United States and European, rather than the Iranian decision makers.
Hadian says the thinking in Washington is that the maximum pressure campaign has worked. It was designed to bring down the Iranian economy, and it's just a matter of time before Iran's leaders agree to negotiate a new deal. But Tehran has been waging a campaign of its own.
We begin, though, with the escalating tensions in the Persian Gulf after that massive attack that crippled key oil facilities in Saudi Arabia.
Over the summer, Iran carried out a series of attacks on oil installations and oil tankers in the Gulf region. It also shot down an American drone.
We have seen a string of attacks in the region that have brought Iran and the U.S. to the brink of military confrontation twice in the past 6 months.
Ali Waiz is with the International Crisis Group, a think tank in Washington. He says President Trump ordered a military strike against Iran in June, but he called it off at the last minute.
This has created this sense in some circles in Tehran that basically, no matter what they do, President Trump would not resort to military action.
That couldn't be further from the truth, Waiz says. Hawkish members of the Trump administration have continuously advocated for military action and regime change in Iran. At the same time, the Iranians have been walking away from their side of the commitments to the 2015 deal, and they plan to do more. Waiz says starting next week, Iran will begin enriching uranium at 20%, close to weapons-grade level.
So we might have a major proliferation crisis on our hands in 2020 if this situation continues.
And remember, 2020 is also an election year, says Jared Blount. He oversaw the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal during the Obama administration. He says Trump faces a tough question in the coming year.
What helps more, appearing to be a deal maker, but at the cost of sitting down with this Iranian regime that has a lot of opponents in the United States, or continuing to present a very hard line?
Blount says he doesn't know what direction Trump is leaning, but he says the status quo is also risky.
It's easy to imagine a miscalculation on one side or the other, which leads to a confrontation.
Meanwhile, Leila Daneshvar, the business owner in Tehran, says it's important for the American leaders to know that the so-called maximum pressure campaign is not just hurting Iran's government.
I can say I have seen with my own eyes how much people are suffering.
I asked Daneshvar what's one thing that she's hoping for in the new year.
I really hope that 2020 is the year that both Iranian and American governments send nice messages to each other instead of hate and, threatening messages to each other.
For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Daneshvar's wish for a peaceful new year may have had a setback over the weekend. On Friday, an Iranian-backed militia group attacked a U.S. base in Iraq. One American was killed, a contractor. Four U.S. military personnel were also wounded. The U.S. Air Force responded yesterday with five different attacks in Iraq and Syria. The Iranian-backed militia says the U.S. airstrikes killed 25 people. It's the first time U.S. forces have struck pro-Iranian groups inside Iraq in almost a decade. Iraq veteran John Spencer is now the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. John Spencer, I have plenty of questions about U.S. contractors in Iraq. But first, you were once stationed at this U.S. base that was attacked. It's known as K-1. It's near Kirkuk. Obviously, it's been a long time since you were there. But what does it look like and what makes it special?
Yeah, so it's a. I was there, back in April of 2003 in the invasion of Iraq. I was an army paratrooper, and we jumped into the north and then moved our way south to Kirkuk. And K1 is a very large army airfield. And any airfield is important to any military, as it's a method of, you know, getting supplies in and out that you need to conduct operations. And it's a big piece of ground where you can train military forces. It's very open, so I could see how easily somebody could get rocket systems near the base and then strike it pretty easily.
So it's still a very active base.
Yes, clearly because of the unfortunate casualties. There are American forces stationed there assisting in ongoing operations for ISIS and in training Iraqi military forces on the behest of the Iraqi government.
And, of course, American contractors. It was an American contractor who died in the attack on Friday. And when I hear the term contractor, I think of that controversial company Blackwater. How close am I? I mean, what is an American contractor these days when it comes to Iraq?
Yeah, we have to be careful on words. So, yeah, some people immediately flashed to the Blackwater incident in Iraq. But at the time, there were more, and it has been since, there have been more contractors in both Iraq and Afghanistan than troops on the ground. And contractor can mean everything from private security contractor, which is kind of what most people think of, or it can mean, you know, the person that's delivering the food, the gate guards.
So you're saying that currently there are more contractors, American contractors, than there are American troops in Iraq?
Not now. At one point, like let's say 2012, there were 117,000 contractors in Afghanistan and only 88,000 troops.
Wow.
There are some that are local nationals and then some third country. I remember when I was in Iraq, I mean, if we went to a dining facility, there was always some third country security guard before we could go in and get our food.
I guess my basic question is still, why do we have contractors? I mean, this is a war zone. Why doesn't the Pentagon use regular military personnel?
There are many reasons. One of them, the biggest reason is it can hide or it can change the numbers that we care about, the number of troops that are deployed. But we also, you know, after 9/11, it takes a lot of people to have forces in any country doing any mission. Just the logistical requirements, the people to drive the trucks, the people to deliver water. It takes a lot of people.
So, okay, I'll just ask it. What's the difference between contractors and mercenaries?
Great question. I'm sure people will argue with me this. I define the difference as a mercenary is a armed individual that a government has paid to achieve its security interests. So that vital line of when you're sending a troop to go destroy an enemy, let's say, that person should not be a contractor. Then to me, he becomes a mercenary. You paid him to go kill for you. We want U.S. soldiers making those decisions.
There are ethical issues here, too. I mean, these contractors are just as likely as soldiers to get hurt or sick or killed. So do these men and women get the same benefits as regular GIs?
No, they're private companies. You're not going to get the benefits a U.S. soldier would. I mean, it's a major difference. So, yeah, they assume a lot of risk in doing what they're doing over there.
Retired U.S. Army Major John Spencer is a veteran of the Iraq War, and he's now the chair of urban warfare studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
On the cusp of 2020, progress in technology and science is astounding. But with new power comes new questions about ethical boundaries. In 2018, Chinese scientist Hu Junhui announced that he altered the genes of babies for the first time. Today, he was sentenced to jail for it. Krishanu Saha is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Wisconsin. Krishanu, what exactly did JK, that's how this Chinese scientist is known, what did he actually do?
He introduced a genome editing tool called CRISPR to alter the DNA within human embryos. And after he introduced this genome editing tool, he transferred those embryos to a woman's womb who eventually gave birth to twins that had modified genes in them. As a result, these twins right now have different receptors on their blood cell surface that is unclear whether it will prevent HIV infection or lead to potentially other types of susceptibilities to different diseases.
But usually CRISPR isn't used for human reproduction, right? I mean, you work with CRISPR. What is it most commonly used for?
Certainly CRISPR is being used in many other places outside of reproduction in crops, in a number of cell and gene therapy projects that I'm part of. And industry is already working on applications for various disorders like sickle cell disease, et cetera, where there's a lot of excitement. I think it's a very interesting time for the field to think about where they want to go with this technology. I think there's been several responses in the wake of the experiment reported in November of 2018. There's a group of scientists, I would argue, that are calling for a moratorium. They've written about it extensively, saying that we need society to step in and tell us whether we're going in the right direction. These questions of where we go is not really up to only scientists themselves. It needs broad societal consensus on places that we should go and places where we should not go. And just because one scientist crossed the line doesn't mean that we should think of it as an inevitable type of place that we're going to go in terms of reproduction.
But in the case of what JK, the Chinese scientist, did, he was doing something that will affect henceforth the genome of future generations of these twins.
Right. Yes, those twins that are out there in China, if they were to have children, their children would have the same genetic modifications that were designed by the Chinese team.
Hmm. Now, one thing I'm curious about is, in the scientific community, is there pressure to be the first to do something no one's done before, you know, however controversial? Is that something that could have motivated JK?
Yes, I think there's pressure to be the first. That's part of, I think, how scientific culture values contributions. And I think there's been some analysis by colleagues of mine that are sociologists or historians and in science and technology studies that have looked at the motivations for JK and can identify some statements that he made that seem to point in that direction, that he wanted to be a trailblazer and in some ways be known and recognized as pushing a boundary.
Is China taking part in these kind of ethical discussions about kind of moving forward as a scientific community globally and all that? Or is China kind of just out there doing its own thing and not part of that conversation?
They're part of the conversation. I think the sentence today illustrates that they're taking this issue seriously to some extent. And certainly I have colleagues that have labs in China that are concerned about these types of experiments. So in some ways, I think it reflects the international nature of this field. JK was not just a Chinese scientist working alone in China. He was trained here in the U.S., talked to colleagues here in the U.S. before conducting a study, and the technology was developed in the U.S. So in some ways, it is partly a international story, not just a Chinese story.
Krishan Usaha is an associate professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Wisconsin. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Marriage isn't for everyone. The wedding, the expense, the social expectations, you know how it goes. But now straight couples in the UK will have an alternative, a legal one, civil partnerships. As of tomorrow, civil partnerships, which previously were only available to gay couples, will be an option for straight couples too. It's the culmination of a long legal battle spearheaded by one British couple. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has their story.
Charles Keaton and Rebecca Steinfeld are rule breakers. It's what attracted them to each other in the first place.
We originally met at a lecture at the London School of Economics, the LSE, that was about Gaza. Yeah.
I think what drew us to one another was the fact we were both quite questioning. We weren't conformist. We were willing to look at things a bit differently.
So when Charles and Rebecca started thinking about the future of their relationship, they knew that a wedding with all the traditional trappings wasn't in the picture.
I felt profoundly uncomfortable every time I went to a wedding where women were being valued as just these sort of passive objects to be handed from one man to another and to be congratulated on the success of their pre-wedding diet. And I just didn't want any of that.
It wasn't just the wedding. Rebecca and Charles felt the institution of marriage itself was too rooted in the patriarchy and in gender inequality.
I just thought, you know, however nice the dress, there's absolutely no way that I want to formalize my relationship in the context of a marriage.
But they still wanted to formalize their relationship somehow. And they both wanted the protections that a legal arrangement could provide, like income tax breaks, inheritance rights if one of them died, or spousal maintenance if they broke up. Things they couldn't get just by living together.
And at the time in the UK, there was this thing called civil partnerships.
Civil partnerships had been around since 2004 for same-sex couples who didn't yet have the right to marry. Critics called it marriage light. But Charles and Rebecca thought maybe, just maybe, civil partnerships might be right for them.
With civil partnerships, there was no pre-existing social script. We were able to think on a blank slate about what we wanted.
So Charles floated the idea of becoming civil partners while they were on vacation in the Pyrenees. Rebecca calls it the proposal, and she remembers it as semi-romantic, semi-political, and very funny.
We kind of had this little tussle about who got down on one knee.
Who proposed
to who? Because I think Charlie maybe initiated the conversation and I was like, no, stop!
So we agreed that we proposed to each other.
There is one problem with the plan. Civil partnerships were only available to same-sex couples. Straight couples weren't allowed to apply. Charles and Rebecca decided to challenge that restriction in 2014.
And they say the rest is, you know, history, a five-year history of taking this issue through the courts and eventually being, you know, successful in the UK Supreme Court.
The court ruled unanimously in their favor, saying restricting civil partnerships to same-sex couples was a blatant inequality. Charles says he'll always remember the moment when he heard they'd won. He and Rebecca were in different places, so their lawyer put them on a conference call to tell them the news.
I was in a car, actually. I was in my car seat, and I put on this song, Blur, Song 2, and it goes, woohoo! And it was just that awesome moment of release, I would say. Rebecca might not know that, but yeah, that was a fab moment in terms of how I experienced it.
It took until March of this year for the government to pass a law opening up civil partnerships to straight couples, with the first ceremonies to be held on December 31st. The government expects up to 84,000 couples to take advantage of the new law in the coming year. Charles and Rebecca will be among the first. They have their big day all planned.
We're pretty much just going to go get it done and sign the paperwork. And then in the evening, we're going to throw a New Year's Eve house party with a love-filled twist. We have asked all of our closest friends to make dishes that they love to cook or remind them of love in some other sense.
Rebecca and Charles have also been hard at work coming up with a music playlist for the party.
The playlist is a combination of like feminist and female power ballads, fight back
protest
anthems. It's like protest music. So it's like that combination, yeah, which I think kind of really accurately sums up our characters.
And of course, there will be one very special song on there by Blur. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Find Minneapolis on a map, then go about 500 miles north and you'll find the tiny town of Sioux Lookout in the Canadian province of Ontario. About 5,000 people live there, and in the past few days, the town's been enjoying some viral fame. The attraction? A roughly 6-foot, 800-pound menorah made entirely out of ice. It lights up with the touch of a button. Dr. Benji Goldstein works and lives in the largely indigenous community. He moved from Montreal to Sioux Lookout to practice rural family medicine. It's super cold up there, and he says the idea for a massive frozen menorah came to him suddenly.
I was collecting milk cartons a couple of years ago because I wanted to build an igloo. I discovered that I wasn't going to be able to build it. But Hanukkah was coming up, and I suddenly had this inspiration to build a nice menorah. It was a nice first draft, and I decided to go bigger this time around.
For version 2.0, Goldstein spent nearly 2 years collecting milk cartons to make bricks of ice.
And the actual labor that went into it was about 3 or 4 weeks, just because the bricks have to freeze for a week or so to make sure they're solid through and through. And then another week or so of labor on weekends mostly.
The giant ice menorah has proved to be a hit in Sioux Lookout. Goldstein says there's only about 10 Jews in town, and he says it's been a pleasure to see all the interest from the extended community.
It was very well received this year. Even before it was finished, people were coming around to see the construction process. We live on a sort of back alley street, and we noticed that people were unexpectedly coming by to see it.
Goldstein hopes the statue might inspire some new holiday ice creations in the future. It's already spawned a knockoff in Montreal.
I was told that after mine was built, a much smaller version suddenly sprung up in one of the parks in one of the Jewish neighborhoods.
Hanukkah may have ended, but Goldstein has no plans to get rid of the giant frozen menorah in his front yard. The extended weather forecast looks solid. Wicked cold up there. Goldstein says he'll continue lighting his menorah every night until nature takes its course come spring. And on that note, we say so long from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.